Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Every 10 years, whether you like it or not, the state's congressional and legislative districts are redrawn to reflect the latest census data. Our system is based on population, and when population shifts, so do congressional and legislative seats. And when population shrinks, as it did in Ohio over the past decade, you lose seats. Ohio has lost 2 seats. The congressional districts are redrawn by a panel of state lawmakers, this year controlled in both houses by Republicans. Hearings started last week. Work on redrawing the boundaries for 99 Ohio House and 33 Ohio Senate districts begins next week by a board made up of the governor, secretary of state, state auditor, and 2 lawmakers, one appointed by the minority party and one appointed by the majority party. Again, Republicans. That puts Republicans firmly in control of that process as well. Today, we'll consider the processes and what they mean for Ohio voters. Coming up later, we'll hear from a national expert in election law and redistricting. Also joining us in the next segment will be Ohio Secretary of State John Husted. Right now, we welcome Catherine Terser. Catherine is the director of the Money and Politics Project and legislative director for Ohio Citizen Action. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Well, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Also joining us is Daniel Tokaji. Dan teaches law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, where he is a senior, fellow of election law. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
Let's see. For some people, this process or the 2 processes are as clear as mud. They routinely confuse them. They don't get the distinction between the congressional and the legislative. Some statehouse reporters sometimes confuse them because they only occur every 10 years. So if you weren't around the first 10 years, it's easy to make a mistake.
Well, and it's so funny. Often you have to say, you know, remember 8th grade social studies, gerrymandering.
Log rolling.
You know.
Yeah, gerrymandering.
Well, anything that takes place once every 10 years and then takes place out of the public eye generally and is a winner-take-all thing is interesting to people that are really in the know. But for lots of us, you know, what is this about? Why does it matter?
It couldn't be more arcane, but it couldn't matter more, right, Dan?
Well, that's exactly right. Although this is something that election law professors pay a lot of attention to, people like me, I think for the ordinary citizen, eyes tend to glaze over. But it's extremely important how district lines are drawn. It literally affects every aspect of our democratic process because how district lines are drawn affects who gets elected to office, what party will control the legislative process, at least in some instances. And it also affects the decisions that people make once they get elected to office. And if we have districts that are safe, in other words, they're heavily weighted towards one party or the other, what we're very likely to get is exactly the sort of stalemate that we see in Washington at just this moment.
Catherine, how does it affect who gets elected?
Well, I always think that's a little bit complicated.
Don't the voters do that?
Well, that's exactly the point. What they try to do is they try to you're the Republican Party in this particular case. Before it was the Democrats, so nobody's saints here. I mean, to be really clear about that. But what they do is they pack people together or they break them apart in a way so that you can create districts that advantage one party way over the other. So basically you're creating what Dan was talking about, these kind of very safe districts for incumbents. And so what they're doing is they're going to be focusing very much on the primary. And when you think about it, if you're focusing on the primary, you're moving either far to the left or far to the right, but you're also not focusing really on kind of ordinary voters. I always say, you know, when we think about this, we're talking about the manipulation of lines, but we're also talking about the manipulation of voters.
We know the old saying, right? If elections are when voters choose their leaders, redistricting is when leaders choose their voters.
Good point. And it can get right down to precincts. It can get right down to streets and the middles of streets.
Right. Even though
it can be very, very specific.
That's exactly right. Even though it's difficult for ordinary citizens to pay close attention to this process, you can be assured that the parties and those who are in office are paying very close attention down to the street or block level as to how district lines are being drawn for obvious reasons. Those who are in power want to make sure that those districts are going to be friendly so that they can get reelected, and maybe those in the state legislature may want to run for Congress in a few years.
And it's good to remember, we in Central Ohio are basically the definition of gerrymandered at the congressional level. If you think about Franklin County, we're cut up, you know, three different ways where you add in the farmlands. And by adding in those areas, what you're adding in are Republican districts. So you basically create these very friendly districts for Republicans. And we know at this point that you know, Franklin County, which is fairly Democratic, right, it basically is represented.
Now, okay. But
the way that they cut it up makes it so that it's very easier for Republicans to get elected. Yes, we know that Mary Jo Kilroy is run for a short period of time, but we have three Republican Congress people representing Franklin County.
Right. If you look at a map of the congressional districts here in Franklin County, it's cut up like three pieces of pie. And the reason for that is precisely to ensure that Republicans will get elected from all three districts, although a Democrat did win in one of those districts, the 15th, in the 2008 election, which, of course, was a very heavy and a year for Democratic turnout.
Presidential, yeah. Right, presidential year.
And it was a tight election.
Yeah.
So Republicans have controlled the process since 1991. So that's two rounds now. They're going into their third round. How much more advantage can they gain at this point?
Well,
Dan's nodding.
It's a really interesting point because I think at the congressional level, it's going to be pretty much impossible for them to draw a lot of new or any new Republican districts. In fact, as you mentioned in your intro, we're going in Ohio from having 18 congressional districts to having just 16. At the current moment, 13 of those 18 districts are represented by Republicans, five by Democrats. The conventional wisdom at the moment, although nobody knows for sure, is that the state legislature will probably have to get rid of one Democratic district and one Republican district. Now, what we're likely to see is the Republicans who control the redistricting process, rather than creating new Republican districts, and this is true in Ohio and a number of other states, what they're likely to do is try to shore up the Republican margins in the districts they already control so as to reduce the possibility of any Democrat getting elected from those districts.
15 out of 18, mm-hmm. And those were districts that were already drawn to favor Republicans.
13
out of 18, and we're going to go down to 16. Mm-hmm. And
I think it's helpful, for people to think about the way that the Democrats, in Congress they're all along Lake Erie. So in many ways, when he's saying, okay, we can't, yes, you can lose Dennis Kucinich, for example, or you could lose, and just throwing it out there, Betty Sutton. But no matter what, there's only so much you can do with the map because they're already dominating the table. I mean, there's only so much you can actually do.
You said that Franklin County's cut up into sort of a pie shape. Hypothetically, how would the Democrats do it? Would they put a big circle around the city of Columbus and that kind of, because it's got to be population based.
I think if Democrats were in control of the process, that's almost surely what they would do. They would create a Democratic majority district that would encompass Columbus and maybe some of the surrounding suburbs. They might also try to do the same thing in the Cincinnati area as well.
Okay. So 10 years ago, Ken Bockwell, Secretary of State, conservative Republican, but there was software developed by then that the supposedly average person could use. He invited the public to use the software. It wasn't very successful. There were a lot of glitches, I guess. But now it's in 10 years, look what we have, in 10 years. And we also have improved software, and you have a contest using it.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Ken Blackwell had this software called Remapping Ohio that was very tedious, very arduous, and just nigh unto impossible to use unless you were really, really focused for a long time. Now, what's different, and you think about 2011, is, yes, it's still very hard to create these maps and move the lines and think about, are you breaking up a township? And thinking about, okay, what about the density of population? All of the different things. It's still, this is not easy to do. But we're fortunate that we have this redistricting competition. It's drawthelineohio.org. Drawthelineohio.org.
And, of course, we'll put that link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. But go ahead, Catherine.
Oh, I was going to say, this competition was initially the brainchild of Joan Lawrence.
Former state rep.
Yes,
yep,
exactly.
Republican.
And just, you know, a wonderful friend and true mentor who, with the League of Women Voters, really advocated for doing this competition. And we initially did it in 2009. I was very happy we had Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner at that point. Basically laid it out, helped us get the message out, and called in people to actually do maps. And one of the things that we were able to say is, okay, you know, it's really hard to think about. How do you balance competition and compactness? And we were able to see how in using 2000 data that it was possible to create maps that were just fairer.
And here's the great thing about this competition, which, again, you can participate in.
And there are cash prizes, by the way,
you know,
people.
That's one of the great things, cash prizes for winners. But and you can find it, again, at www.drawthelineohio.org. You know, for so many issues, Ann, people are outraged by something, but they feel like, well, what can I do about it, right? This is something where you can actually do something that, in our view, could make a difference by participating in this competition. We're going to then compare the plans to the ones that are proposed by the state legislature and by the reapportionment board, and hopefully shame them into drawing a fairer plan.
But there have been different plans proposed for years now. There's always competing plans proposed that are supposedly going to shame one or the other. Obviously, these are from the people, but really, what can people expect? Everything, as you pointed out, Catherine, in the beginning, ultimately the decisions are made behind closed doors.
You know, we could actually throw up our hands and say, oh, nothing's ever going to change. But I think we really are at a point, you know, as our new governor says, this is a new day. I think that in many ways, Republicans are so firmly entrenched that there's no reason for them not to take into account fairness, competition. At some point, you know, finger wagging and shame only takes you so far if one person's doing it.
And, you know, I think it's really easy to get cynical about this process, given the history in this state and other states.
Really?
Right, yeah, really. and you know, look.
Cynicism would be involvement at this point for a lot of people.
That's right. So, well, yeah, good point. Cynicism beats apathy, I guess, right? And Catherine and I both testified at the hearing of this joint House-Senate committee
last week.
The other day. And, you know, they were saying all the right things. Things are going to be different this time. They're going to have a more transparent process. Whether it actually happens, we'll see. But if we don't get involved and try to make the process better, it's certainly not going to happen on its own.
There are going to be public meetings around the state, and we're going to continue our conversation coming up next. The Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, will be joining us by phone, I believe. I think he's even in the studio, so lucky us.
Well, good.
Stay with us. It's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your source for NPR news and local news. Stay up to date with issues impacting life in Central Ohio. The award-winning WOSU News team keeps you connected to the community, and the State House News Bureau has the latest in-depth coverage of state government. Listen to news from across the country and from our own backyard on 89.7 NPR News and streaming online at wosu.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to receive updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up. 81 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny skies today and a high of 89. Clear skies tonight and a low of 67 degrees. More sunshine for Wednesday and a high near 90. And looking ahead to Thursday, sunny skies, a high of 93. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Every 10 years, new congressional and legislative district boundaries are drawn or redrawn to reflect new census data. For years, good government organizations have questioned the fairness of the process, and a few years ago, so did then State Senator and former House Speaker John Husted. Now he's Secretary of State and a member of the apportionment board that will draw the legislative lines this year, and he joins us today to talk about the process and his role in it. Welcome back to the show, Secretary of State John Husted.
Thank you, Ann.
Before we get into that, though, we just learned that Ohioans will be able to vote this November on whether they want to participate in the national health care overhaul. They got enough signatures together.
Yeah, we certified the signatures just earlier this morning, and so it looks like there will be three ballot initiatives. One extending the age that judges can serve, a referendum on Senate Bill 5 as it relates to collective bargaining, and now one on the constitutional nature of the federal health care reform law. So we'll see.
How do you expect this to affect the dynamics of the voting in the fall, given it's
I think for an off-year election, it has the potential, given all the money that's going to be spent, to generate a lot higher turnout than we're used to.
Was it difficult? I mean, how close did they come to getting enough signatures?
They had over 40,000 additional signatures beyond the threshold, something along those lines. I don't recall the exact numbers, but I think it was somewhere in the realm of 40,000.
And the SB 5, that petition got about 1.3 million signatures. This one
that had about 915,000 valid signatures.
Validated.
Yeah, plenty more than what was required.
Is 40,000 more typical?
Particularly when you're spending money to do it, you don't want to spend money to gather more signatures than you actually need. So unless you've got really deep pockets.
One quick thing, and I definitely want to move on to the redistricting thing because we've been having a scintillating conversation up till now. But when voters vote on this, does this change anything about whether Ohio participates in the national health care overhaul?
Well, it would make it unconstitutional, essentially, for the federal government to require us to participate in an individual mandate. But the question is, does the Ohio Constitution override the federal law? There will be debates for people that like to get into those things much more than I do.
There will be debates. Speaking of debates, every 10 years, there's a debate, sometimes behind closed doors, sometimes outside of them, about how we redistrict our congressional seats and also our legislative seats. 10 years ago, in 2001, then Secretary of State Ken Blackwell encouraged public participation. He had a map-making software available to people. It was onerous, but he did have it. Is your office doing something like that?
Yeah, we will be. We're ready to go, except for the actual data that will be used is not ready yet. The actual data that we will use to draw congressional and House and Senate districts is not actually available. We should have it ready to go in the coming days. And so this will be, a system that is advanced by 10 years of technology that will have a greater ease of use. It's essentially the same stuff that we would use if we were in our office doing it, and we'll make that available to the public, and it will have the data that will be updated. This is a really important point that you could actually turn in as a legitimate map based on the same data that the people drawing the maps will be using.
How much, ostensibly, though, does the apportionment board that draws the legislative districts and then the redistricting legislative panel that does the redistricting for congressional districts, how much do they really pay attention to what the public puts forth at this point? Because it's not traditional that the public puts forth their own ideas.
I'm curious. As a member of the apportionment board, I can't speak for everybody else. I'll be curious to see the kind of maps that come in and whether or not there is something there that, is worth trying to sell to the rest of the people making these decisions.
Joe Hallett in Dispatch in April put it this way. He said, if you're a moderate or lean on either side of center, you largely are without representation at the state house. This probably won't change for another 10 years because the system is rigged to elect extremists.
Well, it's a little stronger than I might phrase it, but it's not without some sense of validity. We have to change the system. We're going to have to amend Ohio's constitution for the way that we do this, and essentially create balance. We keep hearing that word in the debate regarding solutions to the national debt crisis. We have to create a balanced system that forces more districts to be competitive. Doesn't mean every district will be competitive, because look, people don't live Democrat, Independent, Republican on the street. You know, they tend to essentially live in neighborhoods with people who have like socioeconomic and backgrounds, and that tends to lead to the same political views. So it's kind of hard sometimes. It's a lot harder to draw these maps in a balanced way than people would like. So compactness, competitiveness, and communities of interest are the three C's that serve as virtues in this. And you can definitely change the culture of how we govern by changing the way that we draw maps. I also think that changing the way that we run elections, instead of allowing the political parties themselves with about 5% of the voters to decide solely who will be your candidates that face off in the fall, perhaps looking at a way to change that, to allow all voters to have a say earlier in the process rather than the general election, I think it can be a positive step, which we did take a small step in that direction in the election reform bill that we just did, but didn't get paid much attention to that.
And the communities of interest, what we're talking about there is where we have not a community of interest, some people might argue, is when you have one lawmaker representing people up in New Albany as well as people down in Canal Winchester.
Yeah, well, dividing a city in four different sections, something like that just doesn't seem to make sense.
As a state senator, you did try to reform the redistricting process and even passed a reform measure that groups like Ohio Citizen Action endorsed, but it died in the House.
Yeah, I couldn't find a way to get enough people to basically say, I'm willing to live with fair versus the winner-take-all opportunity that the last election provided, because you elect on the House and Senate side, if you elect a governor, an auditor, a secretary of state, if you elect two of the three of those, you draw the maps, you're going to have the majority more than likely for the next decade, which will give you the opportunity to then draw the congressional maps, which will give you the majority there for that same decade. And so I was basically trying to say, before we knew the outcome of that election, let's lay it all down. Let's create a balanced system with 7-member board, governor, auditor, secretary of state, 1 Democrat, 1 Republican from the House, 1 Democrat, 1 Republican from the Senate, and require a 5-member supermajority to pass any plan that includes at least 2 votes from members of the minority. It would force them to have to come to the table to find more balance in the system, and it failed.
Yeah, it failed not just by Republican opposition, but Democrats opposed it,
sure,
as well. They were equally opposed.
It was interesting. I could get support from Republicans in the Senate and Democrats in the House, but I couldn't get Republicans in the House and Democrats in the Senate essentially to go along with it. And strangely enough, because I will tell you, not to get into the weeds on this, the Democrats in the Senate have the largest incentive to change the system of anybody in the whole
state.
How many
are there on one hand?
There's hardly any.
Yeah.
I mean, you're either in leadership or you're not. I mean, that's like literally there's so few. And they're good friends. And I tried hard. But there's just such a lack of trust. And so one of the things with any reform that I would advise those who are going to tackle this for the future, and I hope someone will join me in trying to do that, is simplicity. Because every time you try to make something complicated, the people who don't like it undermine it with the complexity. And so a simple system is the way that you can sell this, and that's what I think we got to push for the future.
Some suggest that because of your reform record, you'll get extra scrutiny as a member of the apportionment board drawing the new state legislative lines. What will you do to ensure a fairer process behind the scenes?
Well, you know, I don't know at this point. I wish I had a magical answer for that question. I'm not a deciding vote. And so let's just face it, you don't have a lot of leverage in the discussion when you're not a deciding vote. I'll be an important voice. I hope that perhaps I can get people focused again on the long run. But I'll tell you, this process is already behind the schedule on it. And when you're behind schedule, the chances that you're going to be able to make a real big change, I think, is lessened by that fact.
The deadline for that's October 5th, right?
October 5th for the House and Senate lines.
Right.
The congressional lines are really, there's no limit in when those have to be done, other than, look, you have to have signatures 90 days before you run an election. So if you back it up from the May primary of next year, which is what the law is, you're going to have that done by at least early January. If you have an emergency clause, if you don't have an emergency clause, I think you really need to have it done by October of this year as well.
My guest is Ohio Secretary of State John Husted. Also with us, Catherine Terser of Ohio Citizen Action and Daniel Tokaji of the Moritz College of Law. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Paul and Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, everybody. I believe that in Iowa, possibly Nebraska, but I believe it's Iowa, they have what I understood to be a nonpartisan approach to drawing district lines. Maybe it was just congressional, but it might be all legislative lines. Is anybody familiar with that?
Yeah. I've looked at all these. Iowa has one. There are several other states that have changed. California changed theirs. I proposed an independent board the first time, and then the detractors said, well, we don't like that because those people are not accountable to the public. They're not elected officials. And so I said, okay, fine, we'll do it. Instead of seven members that are more independent-minded, we'll make it seven political folks who are accountable to the public through election. I don't believe in independent voices doing this stuff, because if you know enough to do this, you're not independent. You have a view of this that is political in nature, but that's okay. I embrace the fact that we have some really smart political minds on both sides, Democrats and Republicans. If you just create a system that forces them to have to count on the other to actually pass any plan, they know how to draw fair districts. They know what it is.
And California is, in this redistricting cycle, experimenting with a citizen commission that is a model in some respects like Iowa. And I think we'll all learn a lot from seeing exactly what happens in California, because it is a commission that was expressly designed to be independent of the political process. And here's the argument for that kind of process, that
the citizen commission,
and for something that's independent rather than bipartisan, right? If you've got the two parties working together, you're likely to get a plan that's fairer in terms of proportionately representing Democrats and Republicans, but you may get what we sometimes call a bipartisan gerrymander, a map in which both Democrats and Republicans who are incumbents have safe seats, and it becomes very difficult to dislodge them. And those legislators in turn become less responsive to the people. And the hope with this independent commission in California is that we'll have ultimately more competitive districts and therefore a less polarized and more responsive legislature.
No matter what, and thank you, Paul from Bexley, for that call. No matter what, we have to wait another 10 years before anything changes, right? Our last chance was your bill.
Well, it's But we actually elect the next apportionment board in 8 years or less because of the nature of the way the election falls. And so before we get close to that, I really like the idea of putting something back on the ballot now and preparing for that so that – because once people start to feel like they're going to win, then they don't want to – then they don't want to lay down their arms. Getting it done early before we even know – you know, who might be in control of the process the next time is something I would really favor.
Well, I'm definitely somebody who's always, you know, the cup is half full rather than empty. And I did not look at 2009, 2010 as a failure. I looked at it. We had, three-fifths?
Three-fifths majority passed it in the Senate.
And three-fifths majority passed a different joint resolution in the House. So both the House and the Senate agreed, hey, there's a problem with the status quo. And I think that statement alone kind of pushes reform further along. Well, I think we just need to figure out what works best for us and what we can agree on.
I learned a lot from going through that because you learn about who is going to reject your – on what basis they'll reject your idea. The independent commission is great in theory, but – I learned from the process that I went through that there are many ways to undermine the actual enactment of something like that. Both political parties and their financial bases have a incentive to do that. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to let the perfect be the enemy of the good or the better in this case. And so that's why I have concluded that a bipartisan – and again, we don't say in the constitutional amendment Democrats or Republicans. We talk about majority party and minority party. Because it might not always be Democrats and Republicans, and the way things are going right now, I think that there are more and more opportunities for independent or third party voices to emerge in this process, as they have over the history of our country. Democrats and Republicans don't own this, and things can change.
And I think if we were going to get an independent commission, it would almost it's not going to come from the legislative process. It's going to have to come through a ballot initiative. As it did
and
in California.
I just think
meaning
that
it can't be a legislative initiative. It'd have to get
both parties would have the incentive in that case, though, to raise money and talk about how it's really not accountable to the public because these people
but they have done it successfully in other states. So mm-hmm. that makes me think it's certainly not impossible to do it in Ohio. We're as reasonable as any other state.
Mort in Westerville. Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a suggestion. I'd be interested in your response, and that is that we would take a constitutional amendment, and I suppose it won't happen very soon, but the idea of a shadow legislature composed of retired legislators who no longer would be spending all their time raising money and appealing to their base, but who could concentrate on using their experience and trying to be fair. It would have to be people who are not lobbyists and who are not doing this so they, as a means of getting elected next time. But it would be a true shadow legislature with votes. It should include ex-presidents, ex-governors.
Ambitious? John Houston?
Well, the thing of it is there are 100 different ways you could do this better than it is now. It's just getting people to agree upon that and having people in politics being willing to concede some of their power for the good of what's going on right now. And one of the things that happens when you get into power is that the first motivation for most is to keep the power. And it's human nature. And we're just going to have to get enough people who are willing to say, you know what, I care more about the future of the state, the country, than I care about my own vested interest.
Well, Secretary of State John Husted, you start with the apportionment board next week. I guess a meeting's been called, right?
Mm-hmm.
So good luck.
We're going to try.
All right. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We have to take another break. Thanks to Mort as well for that call. We have to take another break. When we return, we'll hear from John Levitt. He's an associate professor at Loyola Law School, and he's an expert on redistricting. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
89.7 FM is your all-day NPR news station. Listen to local and national news all day, every day. And you can hear the best in classical music on Classical 101. Listen to your favorite composers 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. It's 89.7 NPR News and Classical 101 from WOSU Public Media. For more information, visit WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program begins. While there may be fewer marriages, the number of domestic partnerships is rising. Splits still occur within these households, and fights for custody of children ensue. That discussion on custody battles with domestic partnerships begins at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 81 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today will get up to a high of 89. Clear skies tonight, a low of 67 degrees. Sunny skies for Wednesday, a high around 90 again. Clear skies Wednesday night and a low of 69 degrees. And then more sunshine as we look ahead to Thursday, a high of 93. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We've been talking about the processes by which our congressional and legislative lines are drawn every 10 years as census data shows population shifts. Still with us is Catherine Turser of Ohio Citizen Action. She's one of the sponsors of a public competition to redraw Ohio's congressional and legislative boundaries. There are $5,000 in cash prizes. I should mention.
It's funny because, of course, some of them are scholarships, and it's broken down into smaller amounts to do this. We have one for a high school student, of course, and a law school student. I really hope that we have participants from all around Ohio. And it seems kind of funny to think about you know, people do these things, you know, for democracy, but they might also want to do, you know, a summer project with a little bit of money at the end.
Well, that's what I was thinking, that's what a lot of people might think about it for, teachers and that kind of thing.
Yes.
The OSU Moritz College of Law professor and senior fellow of election law at Moritz, Dan Tokaji, is still with us. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Thank you, Ann.
And joining us now is Justin Levitt. Justin is a national expert in election law, in particular election administration and redistricting. He teaches law at Loyola University. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Thanks very much, Ann.
So how does Ohio stack up at this point compared to other states in terms of how it administers, how it redistricts and reapportions?
I would say it's got pieces of what we see elsewhere around the country. As I know you talked about earlier in the program, for some of what Ohio does, particularly for Congress, the state legislature is really in the driver's seat. For its state legislature, it has a board comprised largely of senior political figures who are actually drawing the lines. And other than that, the rules are fairly middle of the road, with one big exception. And that is that Ohio puts far more weight on county boundaries, on counties as a unit of government, and on recognizing county boundaries than by far the vast majority of states around the country, at least for its state lines. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, Ohio looks, in this respect as in others, like most of the country looks.
Which is not good, good, better, could be a lot better.
Some things to like and some things I can definitely say to improve. And I know that Catherine and the competition that she's been involved with are improving at least one aspect, and that is public input into the process. Another aspect that unfortunately you have to worry about in Ohio that a small but growing number of states are trying to correct, mostly in the western half of the country, has to do with skewed incentives. So in Ohio, and as in most places, those who are in charge of drawing the lines have a really strong incentive to draw them either for personal gain or for partisan gain, even when those things conflict with what the public values. It's very hard to clamp down on that conflict of interest just by driving the rules. You really have to change the decision maker. And in some states across the country, most notably in the West, states have decided to put people who don't have a vested interest in where those districts are drawn in charge of the process.
How do you define not having a vested interest?
The most important part is not being beholden to particular legislators. So if you're drawing state legislative lines, not being beholden to particular state legislators. If you're drawing congressional lines, not being beholden to particular members of Congress. Different states have defined that in different ways, but some of the common elements are you're not yourself an elected official. You're not yourself a legislator. You're not yourself a member of Congress. And, you know, your husband or wife is also not an elected official. Others have tried to exclude from this process very recent prominent lobbyists or those who have pending contracts before the state. Those are some of the basic provisions. And it's not meant, to be really clear, it's not meant to get politics out of the process. What it's meant to do instead is to get particular self-interest out of the process. That is, to ensure that the lines aren't being drawn because your district is going to look a lot better to you or a lot worse to somebody else, or you're not trying to get at a particular challenger or incumbent who happened to cross you the wrong way a few years ago. Unfortunately, where legislators are in charge of the process, we see way too much of that across the country, where the lines are used to reward or punish friends or enemies rather than draw in the public interest.
An earlier caller suggested Iowa as an example of the nonpartisan approach and, you know, possibly something Ohio should look at. Do you have any particular model out there that's operating now that
we could
look to?
There are a bunch of good models. I think the important thing is not to pick one up wholesale and just drop it into Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Iowa has worked really well for Iowans, but Iowa's system structurally, an advisory body that advises the legislature and the legislature is free to ignore it if it wishes, doesn't, but can. Iowa's structure looks a lot on paper like New York's structure, but boy, it doesn't work in New York. And so taking a model from somewhere else, there are bits and pieces that are important to consider, but taking a model from any one state and just dropping it wholesale in another state without reflecting on the political culture there, without reflecting on the demographics there, that's not likely to work. So there are elements in a lot of other states that I like, and whether they fit Ohio or exactly how they fit Ohio depends a lot on Ohio's situation.
Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You want to talk about changing something we haven't talked about yet. What's your plan?
Yeah, would it make this whole process sort of automatically fairer, maybe not perfect, if we doubled, let's say, the size of the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C.? And instead of Franklin County being divided up into three pies, it could be less presumably no one would dare try to divide it up into six pieces of pie, but and therefore you'd have more compact areas sort of automatically.
Would more be less, Justin, or less be more?
Tough to say. I can say that whenever you're talking about no one would dare and you insert X, I would say you've probably seen it somewhere. There's not a lot of it's not a lot to keep those from daring to dream pretty impossible dreams. There's something that's actually similar to what the caller has suggested in a way of divvying up the pie in more and more creative ways, though. And that is, it's a move that a neighboring state, that Illinois, had for 100 years, and that's electing particularly members of the state legislature through larger districts where you elect multiple people from the same district. So having, for example, a big district where you elect three representatives rather than just one. The important bit of that is if you change the way the voting rules work, if you use a system like corporate boards, all use all the way across America, then you actually give different groups within that big district a voice. And that means you have to worry less about exactly where you split up lines to try and give only one group within an area the loudest voice. So Illinois had this for 100 years, and it turned out that most big districts elected two members of one party and one member of another. They elected two people with majority interests and one person with minority interests. And that a lot of people liked that system quite a bit.
If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm talking to Justin Levitt. He's a national expert in election law, in particular election administration and redistricting. He teaches law at Loyola University. Also with us, Catherine Turser of Ohio Citizen Action and Daniel Tokaji. He teaches law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, where he is senior fellow of election law. And caller from Delaware. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I'm kind of astonished at what I'm hearing on this program. What's being described is a self-perpetuating failure, insulated by its own corruption, and pretty much ignored or at least selectively reported on by a codependent media. And I'm stunned by the admission. I always knew that it was there. I can't believe anybody saying this in public.
What specifically are you referring to, or Dan, do you want to respond to that?
I have to agree with the caller's description. Putting aside the part about the media, I think, you know, some people in the media do try to cover this stuff, but it isn't always something that the public pays a lot of attention to, even when it is covered.
To the degree that they selectively cover it.
Yeah, well, we're talking about it now.
Thanks for your call. I appreciate it. So, Justin Levitt, is this? A lot of people are frustrated, like the caller from Delaware. They can't believe that we're even chuckling about this. It's so horrendous. And John Husted, the Secretary of State of Ohio, is pretty out there too about something's got to change. There's some very serious problems, and yet we persist. Is that pretty typical across the country, that frustration?
Both the frustration and the persistence, I think, are pretty typical, which is not to say that something can't be done about it. And the frustration that your callers and that others are feeling does actually have an impact. It sometimes takes a long time to build and a long time to drive different policy. But much of the move in other parts of the country to reform the system has come either from citizen-led ballot initiatives or from big political movements to change the way the system works, recognizing that a problem exists. The first step, getting frustrated about it, and then is a big part of the second step, and putting that into action is a big part of the third step. The legislature has very little incentive to remove its own power, and so they have to be helped along in this respect. The court so far has said they're not going to do much to help that process along. In fact, even where we are, even as much judicial involvement in redistricting as we've got is relatively new. So really what it takes is a lot of people making their views known, and the more people like your caller from Delaware mm-hmm. decide to speak out about it, the better chance there is that something's done.
Yeah, and I think the only way that things are going to change is if people do get frustrated and, in fact, outraged about the way that things are being done now, which is what the caller was rightly expressing, in my opinion. What can you do? Well, one thing you can do is go to the Ohio Campaign for Accountable Redistricting's website, drawtheline.ohio.org, and draw your own map. You can also go to these hearings that the apportionment board will be having, that the committees in the House and the Senate will be having, and testify. And if you've drawn a map, bring that map and hold it up and say, hey, this is a lot more fair, more compact, all-around better plan than what you all are proposing. And I think that if enough citizens get involved and express their outrage to those who are in charge, we can collectively do something about it.
You know, for a long time, up until about probably the early 90s, things were a little bit more – well, they were less split, there was less of a wedge. They were less polarized. What happened? What's the difference? Why did the system work for so long and now it's created this polarization, Catherine?
Well, it's interesting. I was just thinking about John Husted's old district. When he was in the Ohio Senate, he lived in what I call the donut district. Basically, if you looked at Montgomery County, the district that he was in basically had this the suburbs, the Republican suburbs.
Went
all around basically this ring of Republican suburbs to create this district. And you start to think, okay, you know, it is so systemic, and what can we actually do to change this? As you were talking about kind of the change and how people can get more involved, I started to think about, you know, it's been, you know, 200 years since that gerrymander was first drawn, that famous political cartoon that looked like the salamander. And so we're talking about really systemic things that people just get used to. And it's, you know, hard to sustain kind of outrage. But we are exactly in that process right now where there are things that we can do.
Yeah. And you know, you ask a really important question, Ann, which is what's changed? I mean, we've had for centuries in this country people drawing districts based on self-interest. I think a couple of things have changed that have made the problem worse. One is that the technology available to those drawing district lines has gotten better so that it's much easier to tailor a district to one's own political or personal self-interest. The other is that at least in some respects, geographic distinctions based on party have gotten more distinct and more clear. And what I mean by that is people in some areas are predominantly Republican, people in other areas are predominantly Democratic. And that tends to make polarization worse because people who are elected to office feel as though they only have to be accountable to voters of their party, not to anyone on the other side of the aisle. And it worsens the product of the problem of gridlock that we see in the debate over the debt limit right now, where we have people on both sides who are simply unwilling to compromise. In fact, look at it as a dirty word. I'm not saying that redistricting is the only thing that's responsible for this, but it's a part of the problem.
Justin Levitt?
There's also there's a silver lining in all this, which is true. The problems and the legislative dysfunction seem to be getting worse, but the solutions actually do seem to be being brought up and being put in place. And Martin Luther King said the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And that means an awful lot of effort and a lot of frustration, but we'll get there eventually. And I think what you're seeing is other states leading the way to fixing some of the increasingly serious problems we have. There are models elsewhere in the country, and those help to alleviate some of the very real and very frustrating problems that Dan and Catherine and your callers have been talking about. There is a way out, and people are starting to see it and find it and put it into a place.
Well, thanks for helping us talk about it today, Justin Levitt.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the program.
You got it. Justin Levitt, he's a national expert in election law. He teaches law at Loyola University. And also with us, Daniel Tokaji. Daniel, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
Appreciate it. Dan teaches law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, where he is senior fellow of election law. And Catherine Terser, glad you could join us again today.
Well, thank you. I had such fun.
It is fun. How do we do this? How do we make this fun?
You know what? I frankly love talking redistricting.
Catherine is director of Money and Politics, the Money and Politics Project, and legislative director for Ohio Citizen Action. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.